Alaska, and we're having a hearing on the subject of MICA and President and Representative Lehman, Representative Finkelstein, and Representative Donnelly. And I'd like to open today with just there's a general concern with the situation with MICA now. We've had the tax issue that's been with us for several years. We had legislation before the legislature last year which would have exempted MICA from the premium tax to help it deal with its tax, the tax implications on the federal level. That legislation didn't pass. MICA has now entered into an agreement with the Internal Revenue Service, and we'd like to have a general discussion of the impact of that agreement, where that looks like we're going now. There's also the issue out there of a potential sale of MICA, and we wanted to get something on the record here so we know what we're going to be looking at coming into the next legislative session, because if it was sold or the tax ramifications became a big enough problem, we're going to have to look at some sort of legislative solution to the problems those present also, and it'd be nice to get a little head start on them so we would be working on them in a fresh, with just a go cold turkey during the session, especially given the time frame on the tax agreement. So with that brief introduction, I'd go ahead and maybe introduce Mary Pierce and ask if she could just give us a general rundown with where MICA is now with the tax situation and the potential set.
Chairman Dong and members of the committee, I guess what I'd like to do is start out with the closing agreement and give a brief synopsis of that closing agreement, and that will probably set the stage for where MICA is at the moment.
The members in their files, there's a copy of the closing agreement with the IRS and
Very briefly, from what led up to the closing agreement was in late 1987, our auditors, who were then Ernst & Winnie, who have now merged to become Ernst & Young, advised us that the 1986 Tax Reform Act may have an implication on changing our tax-exempt status. The Board of Governors, on advice from counsel and on advice from Ernst & Winnie, chose to ask the IRS for a tax ruling. We did do that and spent some time working with the IRS back and forth in Washington, D.C. In 1989, we asked the legislature to pass a resolution, which it did, declaring that MICA was an instrumentality of the state. The question was twofold, and that was, were we in fact created for public good, and did our profits inure to the state? And those were the two questions that the IRS had with MICA. We ended up working through the governor office in Washington, D.C., and through Senator Ted Stevens' office in Washington, D.C. And the results of all that were we negotiated, and I'm using that term loosely because negotiating with the IRS is must be an oxymoron or something of some sort. But anyway, we did finalize all that with a closing agreement. The terms of the closing agreement were as follows. MICA was to be relieved of any liability, tax liabilities that it had outstanding, and those were for the years 1987, 1988, and 1989. That was around $3.3 million, which is not exactly an insignificant sum to a company the size of MICA. And we had never collected for those potential taxes, so we would have had to, if we had to pay those taxes, we would have had to assess the policyholders in order to pay for those taxes. It also relieved us of tax liability for 1990 and 1991, and potentially for some tax liability in 1992, but that's kind of something I'll address if someone wants to talk about it. But basically, it relieved us of tax liability from 1990 through 1991. The result of all that was that we probably were relieved of over $5 million in taxes. And that was, again, not insignificant in our minds. What we had to do, though, as a requisite for that relief was to basically, we were faced with restructuring MICA. The only way that we could maintain our tax exempt status was to become an integral part of the state, i.e. maybe a department under the Division of Insurance or something like that. So we had a variety of options available to us. And one of the requirements that the IRS insisted on was that MICA make known its statutory provisions for acquiring its assets and liabilities. And their reasoning for this was that MICA may be playing a part in the market and actually marketing its insurance and taking over part of the market that a commercial carrier would come into if MICA wasn't there. In other words, if MICA wasn't present, MICA wasn't selling insurance policies, then an insurance carrier might come in conceivably and fill in that void. But because MICA was present and because of its a favorable rating structure due to the fact that it wasn't taxable and it had some premium tax advantages, that no company would come in. So we were required under the terms of the closing agreement to send out the provisions of the statute for acquiring our assets and liability to all admitted malpractice carriers in the state. There happens to be 21 admitted malpractice carriers in the state. Now, some of those don't write physicians or hospitals. Some of them write dentists, some of them write nurses, some of them write some of the hospitals, i.e., for instance, Aetna writes Providence Hospital. But we did, in fact, get that list from the Division of Insurance, and we sent letters to all admitted carriers in the state, 21 of them. Also, under the terms of the closing agreement, we were to pick 5 other commercial companies and mail the same provisions to those. The Board of Governors and MICA has been associated with the National Organization of Physician-Owned Insurance Companies. And what we chose to do was to send out those letters to 5 of those that were philosophically as closely aligned to MICA as possible, and also regionally were present, were close to MICA. And what I mean by that is they're philosophically, the Connecticut company, for instance, is closely aligned with MICA, but regionally, we just didn't know how that was going to work. So we chose 5 companies that we thought would be potentially able to, and philosophically close to MICA, to send this letter to. We also had some other considerations when we sent out that letter. We wanted not just a company that was physician-owned that only wrote physicians, but also someone that had the capability of writing our hospitals and our related health care, because a lot of physician-owned companies only write physicians. So that was another consideration that we had when we sent out the letters. So what we ended up having then for choices or options or alternatives was, number one, to become an integral part of the state and remain tax-exempt. Number two, to restructure as a private insurance carrier, probably a mutual, since that's most like what we are currently, statutory provisions now, we're probably closer to a mutual than a stock company, for instance. Or we could be bought by one of these companies that we sent the letters to. There was some discussion of being exempted under federal law, and I'm forgetting the fifth alternative. Yeah, I thought that one. That was number one.
Bring it in, spin it off, sell it.
Yeah, or we could sell it. Or we could, the other thing, obviously, to do was that we could turn it back to the state and say, liquidate MICA, because there are provisions under the statute to do that. So that was something else. The options as we knew them led us to start to talk to various people that might be a key in those options truly being potential options. One of the things that we felt was not going to be an option, and that was to become an integral part of the state. And the reason for that was is that the state administration, at least Governor Cooper, as early as 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago, suggested that the state should not be in the insurance business, and that they thought it was inappropriate, or he thought it was inappropriate, for the state to have to assume that kind of liability. So that was one option that we thought was probably not going to be a viable option. The other option that that we had was for MICA really to stay exact, that's the fifth option, for MICA to stay exactly like it is and become taxable at the end of 1991. That option had further implications, and what we understood from the state, both from the state administration, is that if MICA as an instrumentality of the state became taxable, there were other public corporations of the state that would then potentially have that liability of becoming taxable. And that this was not an acceptable alternative. So that was the other option that we decided was probably not an option. And the legislators that we talked to a couple of legislators, also felt that that was probably not a viable option. So the Board of Governors at that point in time felt that restructuring was the option that was most available to us. And potential that we had for restructuring was that we would have to go to the legislature and have to be restructured as a mutual. We did not perceive at that point in time that someone would actually want to purchase MICA. That statute's been on the books to sell MICA since 1978. No one's ever wanted to buy us. We have in the past even talked to people about buying us, and that has not been something that they've wanted to do. But as it turns out, the unusual happened, and our choice of five companies that we sent to, the top choice of those five companies, came to us and said, "We are interested in discussing this further." That set off a long series of discussions. It's been only within the last month or so that these have really accelerated to the point where we are negotiating terms, and we have an agreement on a lot of those terms. The company is based in San Francisco. I can tell you, I'm free to release the name of the company. It's called NorCal. They are a physician-owned company. They started in 1975. They started out insuring rural physicians in Northern California in 1975. The majority of their business is still rural physicians. A year ago, they went into Oregon. Were invited in by the family practice docs in Oregon, and they insure currently about 200 doctors in Oregon, family practice physicians and other specialties. They have, like I stated, have agreed to the terms that the board has come up with, and have the capability of writing hospitals, have the capability of writing physicians, have the capability of writing related health care. I think that possibly our chairman of the board, Dr. Keller, can better state those terms if the committee would like to hear exactly what those terms are that the board has felt were non-negotiable in our negotiations with NorCal. But we're at a point right now where the in following the statute, the board potentially may be receiving an offer from NorCal at the next quarterly board meeting, which is on November 2nd. We anticipate that we will be receiving an offer from NorCal on November 2nd. And under the statute, the board would have to approve that offer, and the director of the Division of Insurance would have to approve that offer. That's, in a nutshell, where we are. Sorry, I couldn't be so long, but it's kind of complicated. We would be paying off the outstanding loan that we owe the state of Alaska. The amount outstanding at this point in time is $2.7 million. There is a question about who owns the surplus of MICA. It's a $64 million question. We had one posture when we went to the IRS that it was owned by the state of Alaska, but we're unclear as to who owns that surplus. There is an argument that it's also potentially owned by the policyholders because they've been making an investment in MICA for the last 15 years. So who owns the surplus is still a question, and a question that needs to be decided. I also have our corporate counsel here, Roger Holmes. I think he can better speak to that than I can as an attorney. But that is a question mark that's going to be one that either the legislature or a court or someone's going to have to decide. But it really doesn't impact the sale of MICA. But we are running at the end of August of this year, a $9.3 million surplus. So that's something that's going to have to be decided in the future.
Before I forget, I want to ask a question. How does the surplus relate to the issue of tails, tail coverage on physicians? MICA was to be bought, the company that buys it is assuming all that responsibility for the tail coverage. Am I phrasing this right?
Yes.
Understand what I mean?
Yes. There's several ways to structure that, Representative Donnelly, but if in fact the company purchased MICA, both the assets and the liabilities, then what would happen is that we have built-in reserves for those tail policies. We have built-in reserves for the claims that are still pending. They would be purchasing, or in effect, be accepting those reserves too. So there is a built-in amount of money that we reserve for both the tail policy and for outstanding pending open claims. And that's about $10 million at the moment. But that's a liability. That's something that's on our books at the moment.
That's
independent from the surplus. Surplus is, if we were a stock company, the best way to explain the surplus would be an underwriting profit would probably be the best way to explain the surplus.
Is the surplus actually cash that's somewhere out there?
It's on paper. It's on paper as a surplus. And yeah, it's cash.
It's real.
Yeah, it's real.
Is it just it's in some financial institution somewhere, I'm guessing?
Yes.
I'm really surprised. I thought over the last 4 years, I kind of followed MICA pretty good. And we've been holding down, you've done a good job of holding down the rates. At the same time, managed to build up this pretty substantial surplus. I don't know, what was the function of the surplus?
The function of the surplus is basically to provide MICA with the financial stability to provide rate stability, which led to the rate decreases. I mean, the function of the surplus is to provide that kind of cushion, if you want to speak to it, if you want to look at it like that, provide the financial stability that, in effect, protects us as far as the rates go. It's also, Representative Donnelly, it's an actuarial guesstimate what the rate should be on an annual basis. And last year, because we ended up with a surplus, we gave a dividend to the policyholders, and it's not called a dividend under the statute, it's called a payment under the statute because we're not a mutual insurance company. But we did give a dividend because we recognized that we were running not profit. profit is the wrong word because it's not profit. But in effect, we recognize that we were running over what we expected for the rates, so that all policyholders received a 5% dividend. And you want to, Walsh may have some further clarification of all of that. But
well, it's just that, to me, the question this raises in the big picture is that Mica, since its creation, has been able to charge less rate for its coverage, it just seems it's been able to do, and not have the same increases that occurred with the other insurance in this market, and still build up a $64 million surplus.
No, 9.3.
Oh, this had 9.3.
I think, if I may interject...
Or is that the reserves, the 9.3 is reserves?
No, 9.3 is a surplus.
Okay. When Ms. Pierce said that there was a $64,000 question, she meant that, or $64 million question,
okay.
She meant that euphemistically,
right.
As opposed to that there was $64 million.
Okay, so the reserves are about $10 million and the surplus is 9.3?
Yes.
Okay. See, I think you're real serious.
Well...
Yeah, I got to tell you my answer.
Well, the $9.3 million is net of the 2.7.
Right. So you have the ability to pay the 2.7
yes.
In addition to that.
Exactly.
Okay. So now I'm understanding this better now.
What
is that, remember? Oh, I should record should reflect we've been joined by Vice Chairman Grove.
Thank you. What's the difference between surplus and reserve?
Well, surplus is your net worth. And surplus is your profit, and reserves are liabilities. And reserves are your liabilities that you're setting up, assuming that you're going to have, as time progresses, a payment to be made. Medical malpractice is a really long tail kind of claim. So, you know, on average, we don't go to trial until 5 years, 4 to 5 years after the claim is made. In the meantime, we have to set aside reserves, knowing that inflation and cost of medicine and wages and everything else are going up.
Are the reserves set up based upon the amount of the claims? How do you determine what the surplus is?
No. We set up the reserve based upon our estimate of what the claim is going to finally, if in fact we become, if we lose the case, we go to trial. We set up the reserve based upon what we think is going to be the exposure. What's at risk? And we don't pay any attention to what the plaintiff is asking for.
Now, the people who pay the premium, the policyholders,
yes.
Are claiming that they are entitled to the surplus?
No, they're not claiming that they're entitled to anything. The question is, who owns a surplus, Representative Bloomberg? And it's not something that we have answered yet, who owns
what
the surplus.
What is the basis of their claim that they own the surplus?
Well, as I stated, they haven't claimed, the policyholders haven't claimed that they own anything. It's just that we have this amount of money here that we're not really sure who owns.
Why aren't you sure?
Well, can I jump
yes,
in,
why don't
Mr. Chairman?
I'll get an answer yet. I'll phrase it.
Okay. The pot of money that's there is, in my view, arguably made up from two sources. One is policyholder excess. That amount actually paid by the policyholders in dollars that are excess of claims and costs. I think that an argument can be made that that portion of the surplus belongs to the policyholders who paid it in.
Why?
Because they paid it in.
So in other words, when I pay State Farm, if I pay them too much, I get some of it back?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Is that under law?
Yes.
That's true on any policy?
On any mutual. For mutual policies, and most of the State Farm companies are mutual companies, that's true. Many times you get a check in the mail at the end of the year. The other, because in mutual companies, the policyholders own the company. For stock companies, that amount of money in excess of surplus is dividends. And so I think that there is an equity argument to be made.
Is there a claim that MICA is a mutual?
It is more like a mutual than anything else. in terms of how the corporation actually behaves.
Right. Now, you said that part of it was this.
Okay.
What's the rest?
The second part of it, I guess I should have started out by saying do what they used to do on Face the Nation, and that is to make a statement without stating a point of view. I think these are the arguments. I don't know how they break down at this point. But the other part of it arguably belongs to the state, because for 15 years, MICA has received two kinds of state benefits. First of all, low-cost financing. The MICA loans have been outstanding and the payments have been made, et cetera, but there isn't any question that there was an investment in the corporation by the state in the form of providing low-cost financing. The second area is the amount of premium tax that MICA would have otherwise paid had they truly been a private company. And I think that you can make a good argument that the state has some equity in whatever amount of money is left after MICA's debts are paid and after all the claims are paid off. And as Ms. Pierce said, I don't know the final answer to that question. But kind of the way that I'm drifting at the moment is that there is certainly some state equity there that needs to be realized. And I think arguably there's some policyholder equity that needs to be realized as well. I think that it would be patently unfair to say, even though there's a state investment in this organization, we will forego that and give the policyholders 100%. I also think that it would be pretty unfair to say, as a policyholder, you have paid in your premiums, it has been built up under extremely conservative, and I might add, very good financial principles, and now there's this pot of money, part of which you have paid out of your pocket, and it's all going to the state. Thank you very much. I think either the alternative at either extreme becomes unpalatable. I think that where we'll probably wind up, where we are wind up, is somewhere in the middle, because there is no question that the policyholders have a hard dollar investment in MICA from which they have received a benefit. There's no question about that. And that the state has a hard dollar investment in MICA from which, arguably, all of us who use medical services have seen a benefit as well.
And the statutes don't answer the question?
No.
No.
Sure.
Representative,
I have a question for Mr. Walsh, or perhaps Mary Pearson can answer. How would some type of compromise, which I came to the same conclusion when I addressed it, for maybe similar reasons, but how would that jeopardize, or would it at all jeopardize, the settlement with the IRS in light of the past claims that MICA was an instrumentality of the state?
I don't think that it would jeopardize it at all, because as part of before we get to that point, MICA is sold and goes away. And there is no question in anyone's mind that whoever buys it would in fact be a taxable entity.
You mentioned that the state foregoed premium tax payments for MICA, and I thought that MICA did pay the same premium tax as...
They pay a lower premium.
They pay a lower premium tax. Well, that's interesting.
First 5 years they were exempt.
First 5 years they were exempt, and
oh, okay.
Since then they've paid a lower tax.
Was that in creating the enabling statutes? So the first 5 years they were exempt. And then what is their current rate compared to other?
1.5 is compared to 2.7.
And they're the only insurance company that pays that 1.5. I would think nobody else
Correct.
Is on that. And that, I guess, yeah, that brings me back to, I guess, the big picture that at some point in time I'd like to talk about here today, and that's if MICA goes away, or you know, if it goes away as a public entity, it's going to lose those tax advantages, and whoever takes it over is going to be a private firm. They're going to be in the same situation as the other private firms, which haven't offered as good a coverage as MICA. From what I can see, the rates haven't been as good. And so are we going to be back to the problem that we were trying to solve when we created MICA and have to create a new MICA or a new public corporation to deal with the problem again?
Yeah, this is the issue that we refer to with the division as the son of MICA question. You know, are we going to solve this problem and wind up creating son of MICA at a future date? And again, I can just share my thoughts with the committee. I don't think we're at the point where we've reached any conclusions. There isn't any question, as Mary mentioned before, that when the MICA statute was passed, it was with the prospect that MICA could eventually be sold. I think that it's fair to characterize the creation of MICA as essentially a bridge device to bridge a gap in medical malpractice coverage that the state was experiencing. I don't know, but my guess is that it was not the intent of the legislature at that point to create a permanent state-owned insurance company or a quasi-state-owned insurance company. And I think that the argument can be made that we, assuming the NorCal bid comes through, we are now faced with a ready buyer with cash money who, if they follow the guidelines of the MICA Board of Directors, is willing to guarantee that for 5 years, the rural hospitals, the OBGYNs, the rural docs, the people for whom MICA was created, will indeed have coverage. And so I think that it's probably legitimate to say that the gap has been bridged. And if in 5 years we need to face the fact that another gap has arisen, then we do that at that time. The legislature can also decide that as a hedge against that eventuality, we will create Son of MICA now. Perhaps use whatever portion of the proceeds in yours to the state to fund it, et cetera. I guess there's an upside and a downside to that. The upside is then whatever facility would be necessary would already be created and in place should it be needed. The downside is that it could very easily become the hefty bag of medical malpractice in the state. And that is, it would encourage the other writers in the marketplace to raise their underwriting standards to a point where they were taking the cream. And the only thing that that Son of MICA was getting was the absolute bottom of the barrel.
Can I back up before I forget you? You said that part of the sale agreement is guaranteed coverage for 5 years. How about rates for the 5 years?
Well,
I can cover anybody if I charge enough rates, right? I mean, if I raise the rate time.
I don't think anyone knows what the offer is going to be. I certainly don't. I'm just going by the criteria that we had set up and that the MICA board had come to independently, basically. There is no way that any carrier can provide comfort on rates to anyone over that period of time. The only thing that, the check and balance there is that I think it's likely that the division would approve rate filing with massive increases that weren't justified actuarially by losses.
But that it's going to be presumed that their costs are going to go up at least 1.2% over MICA's just because of the premium tax difference, right?
Well, except for Representative Donnelly, if we were to stay as MICA and become taxable, we're looking at a 10 to 15% rate increase.
So the
just
new,
to stay tax, so just, you know.
The new people are going to be subject to that taxation, plus they're going to be subject to an increase in the state premium tax, too.
Right? Except for the fact that they've already factored that into their operation. I mean, they've been taxable all along, a taxable entity all along. We're also talking about a $500 million company. MICA is about depending upon what you're looking at, we pull in gross written premium, for instance, this year of about $5.7 million. So our income is considerably less, and they can absorb those kinds of increases where we can't absorb those kinds of increases. They have what is commonly known in insurance terminology, they have spread of the risk. They have 10,000 policyholders. We have around 300 policyholders. They have indicated that in looking at our rate filing done by our actuary that they're really comfortable with where we are right now, and they have the capability of decreasing rates. They have the capability of decreasing rates that we don't have, and that's based strictly on the size. Right now, we have a 40% contingency factor, which is a 40% loading in our rate. Some of that is for the reinsurance that we have to pay. Obviously, they have greater leverage in the reinsurance market, too. But some of that is for our size and volatility of the business that we're in. And we're just so small. We are the smallest medical malpractice company of anywhere in any of the states. I mean, we're just tiny. And we have to have considerations in our rates for that contingency, for that fact that we are in a volatile marketplace, and we're just small. We can't afford to take large hits. I mean, we would be back to the legislature asking for another loan. So that's part and parcel of it. They have the capability of if anybody has the capability of decreasing rates, they have the capability of decreasing rates.
Record should reflect we've been joined by Representative Senator-elect Collins.
Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you. I don't have as much experience with Mike as some of the other committee members, so my questions are obvious. It just gets to the, I'm trying to understand why do we want to change MICA's status in the first place. I mean, the old proverb, why fix it if it isn't broken? I guess the message I'm getting from you is there's a potential for lowering rates. Is that the only motivation?
No, I think I can probably answer that better. I don't think MICA was broke until the IRS got into it. With the IRS determination that MICA is a taxable entity, and the state's position through a letter from the governor and a resolution by the legislature that MICA is a state instrumentality, it creates what is an untenable premise, and that is that a state instrumentality is taxable. And that's what's broken. Now, there is a policy question, which is far above my level. It's basically a gubernatorial and legislative policy level issue as to whether or not it is acceptable to have state instrumentalities taxable. In the worst case, if that principle becomes generally accepted, there are a number of state instrumentalities, such as the Permanent Fund, ADA, AHFC, et cetera, that may fall under the same thing. And when this decision was presented to me, I bumped it to the governor's office, as I said, because it is above the level of the Division of Insurance. And it's a position of the administration that it is not acceptable to have a state instrumentality taxable under any way, shape, or form.
Sure.
Yeah.
I guess I still don't understand it. I understand the logic there, but it makes sense that you might have a problem with having a state instrumentality being taxable, but why it's considered to be a solution to just get rid of that, whatever it is, whatever policy is still out there still exists. It isn't like we're going to change the policies by eliminating what entity has brought about the decision. We're not winning the war, in the battle of whether or not the state entity should be taxable. We're just giving up. I mean, and I don't see how it's a solution to that issue.
Well, I think the choices, and again, this is more personal opinion than insurance opinion, because I've said twice before, this is at a policy level much higher in the organizational chart than I am. The policy decisions at this point are to basically let a state instrumentality become taxable, attempt some type of judicial action to overturn the IRS decision, or something else, which no one has yet come up with. Because the agreement has been signed, and this is something that would be better asked of the governor's office, no legal action has been taken to date, of which I'm aware, and I don't know of any that's contemplated.
And so the division was left, and Michael was left with exploring other alternatives. And in that other alternative are the six things that that Mary mentioned. A congressional fix saying, despite the IRS closing agreement, Congress hereby declares Michael will not be taxable. Senator Stevens' office feels pretty strongly that that would be a hard pull anyway, and that was before the current budget problems that they're going through. The second solution would be to essentially spin MICA off and let them truly become private. Let them pay premium tax, income tax, survive as an entity as it exists now without any of the state financing, tax breaks, etc. Mary can probably speak to the economic viability of that better than I can, but I think in a nutshell, my understanding is that because of MICA's size, that would be a difficult proposition at best. The third alternative would be to essentially bring MICA into the fold, truly make it a public entity, and then go back to the IRS and say it is now a division of, and fill in the blank for the department, and hope to solve the problem that way. The fourth alternative would be to essentially allow MICA to bleed off its book of business and die. To say there are now other carriers out there in the marketplace who will pick up these insureds and we'll just let them go. And we will not worry about getting a return on the investment that the state and the policyholders have. We will give up and just let our book of business bleed off. The next alternative is to basically disband MICA, to just repeal the statutes, determine how the surplus ought to be divided up, and let the policyholders fend for themselves. And then the last alternative is to find a willing buyer who's willing to buy MICA's assets and the book of business, assume their liabilities. And I don't want to speak for Mary or her organization, but from our point of view, given the alternatives that we have to work with at our policy level, that seems to be the most viable one, the one that provides the greatest return on the investment, and the one that, at least arguably, protects the policyholders for the greatest length of time in a fashion which is going to harm them the least.
Right, and Mr. Chairman, and one of the other alternatives you're looking at, too, is just leaving it as it is, right? I mean, that is an alternative.
That is not really an alternative that we can look at. I mean, that's a legislative and gubernatorial overall policy decision as to whether or not you want a state instrumentality tax. The division has been operating with the understanding that for this administration that is not an acceptable alternative, and I believe that MICA has been doing the same.
That we're going to get a report that says what's necessary for the IRS to consider them to be tax exempt, and that would solve the problem.
No, the only thing that's considered to be is we become an integral part of the state. The IRS has already determined that the only way that we can maintain a tax exempt status after 1991 is to become an integral part of the state. That is the only way. Everything else leads to being taxed.
Okay, and what does that mean?
A taxable entity.
To them, what is integral part of the state mean?
A division under the Division of Insurance or under the,
probably,
you know,
Health and Social Services or Administration or Revenue, one of those departments. It would be very difficult for us because we can't provide and regulate at the same time.
Right.
And that's also a policy decision that is legislative and gubernatorial, and that is, does the state want to get into the business of being a provider of insurance? And the reason we are proceeding along the sale track is that from what we can do in this situation, the decision to allow a state entity to be taxable or to bring MICA in as a state agency, a true state agency, are both decisions that neither MICA nor the Division of Insurance can affect at all. I mean, we need to find a solution by 92. So we are proceeding with the pieces that we have to deal with. The bigger pieces, the larger philosophical pieces, are things that the legislature and the governor
they choose to address.
Just one other consideration, too. The MICA Board of Governors did sign a closing agreement with the Internal Revenue Service, and as part of that, we have to, we have no choice but to look with and negotiate in good faith any offer or any interest that we might receive from a potential buyer. So we've been, you know, when we originally were shown interest by this company, NorCal, we felt that we needed to follow the terms of the closing agreement. What the board's been very careful about is to make sure that we follow the terms of the closing agreement with the IRS, and also are within the confines of the statute and are doing everything that we should be doing based upon either the terms of the closing agreement or the current statute. So.
Okay,
it's been a big consideration.
Joined by Representative Boucher, I have Representative Greenberg, and then Representative Collins.
I have a couple questions. You mentioned that there are some subsequent documents, something that is subsequent to the enactment of the MICA Act, that terms MICA as a, quote, instrumentality of the state. So what are those once again?
There was a resolution passed by the last legislature, both houses unanimously, that declared that MICA was an instrumentality of the state. Similarly, there was a letter that went to the IRS from the governor's office stating that MICA was a state instrumentality.
Do you have copies of those documents?
I think I have a copy of the resolution here.
If we could ask staff to distribute copies of that, I'd like to see that, if I may continue, Mr. Chairman. Suppose the legislature passes a statute, and then a subsequent legislature passes a resolution that seems to be at odds with the statute, and I would call the members' attention to the statutes that we have in our packet. Look at AS 21.88.020, which is found at page 381, and it says, corporation created. There's created the Medical Indemnity Corporation of Alaska, which is a public corporation having a legal existence independent of and separate from the state. Obligations issued by the corporation do not constitute a debt, liability, or obligation of the state or a pledge of full faith and credit of the state. I have difficulty squaring that with what somebody said in the subsequent resolution, don't you?
Apparently the IRS did as well. If I could, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to kind of go to the next step.
Well, before we go to the next step, my legal question to you as a lawyer is that if you have a statute and then there's a subsequent resolution, which presumably doesn't have the force of law, I don't even know if this was a joint or concurrent resolution. It was concurrent. It wasn't even signed. The governor doesn't have any of it.
I don't know. It was before my time.
I don't think you can vary a statute by simply passing a resolution. That's one question. And secondly, and equally important, I don't think that these are all the possibilities of solving this problem at all. I can give you a couple more ways of solving the problem. And number one is simply run MICA so there's no income. That you go on a zero base like you do with a closely held corporation.
The problem with that is that in order to have solvency in an insurance company, you need a couple of levels of cash, of money. You need the reserves which you set aside to pay your reasonable estimate of what your claims are going to be. To be honest, I don't know whether those are taxable or not.
Well, that's my question.
Okay.
They are.
Okay.
A percentage of them are taxable.
Okay.
So you could be running with no income and still have reserves
right.
to be taxable.
Okay, then if the reserves are taxable, then we have trouble right there.
Well, then there's another way of dealing with that, too, and that would be assume that money paid to the state is deductible on your federal income tax. State income taxes are deductible on your federal income tax. We could simply pass a statute that taxed those in an equal amount at the state level, thereby making it all deductible at the federal level and passing it back to the state and then dealing with that back to the corporation by a series of appropriations.
The problem with that is it would eat up the next layer of solvency comfort, and that's obviously not a term of ours, it's just something that occurs to me right here. You want an insurance company to have a hefty cash surplus for a number of reasons.
Sure.
You know, their estimate of what may happen in court could be wrong. Their estimate of losses in any given year may be off. There could be a catastrophic event. Their cost of operation for some event, pretty much beyond their control, could escalate. The cost of their reinsurance could go up, any number of things. That block of money is clearly taxable. If they had to take out of that a sufficient amount of money to give to the state, to get back, etc., my guess is that it would be the old situation where you'd lose money on every one of those transactions, but you'd make it up in volume. I think that by the time it got back, there would not be enough there to make MICA and then MICA's policyholders have a great deal of comfort as to the overall level of solvency. And one of the things that MICA has done over the last 15 years is they've had extremely conservative accounting practices, which accounts for the liberal reserve.
What you're talking about, Mr. Walsh, on a policy basis, is that this is the foot in the door, or the nose under the camel's nose under the tent, or whatever. And if they can tax MICA, they can tax AHFC, and all these others. I can't believe that the Medical Indemnity Corporation of Alaska is the first entity of this type in the entire United States ever to meet this problem. I'm wondering how other states dealt with it.
We are really unique. We hired a tax attorney. We had both a very capable, competent attorney who is an aide to Senator Stevens in Washington, D.C., working on this. We had attorneys in the governor's office in Washington, D.C., working on this. We hired our own tax attorney in town, Bruce Gagnon from Atkinson, Conway & Gagnon, working on this. We also had tax legal advice from our auditors, Ernst & Young in Washington, D.C.
Maybe we're too unique.
We are.
Maybe we are
very, very unique.
Maybe we should do something that other states have done so that they don't get into this problem.
No, all other states are taxable. What we really got is that we are so unique that we actually had a case in front of the IRS. And we took this not just to the IRS, but through our connections in Washington, we took it to the Department of the Treasury, which is the boss of the IRS. I mean, we talked to the chief counsel of the Department of the Treasury, and they were very sympathetic and felt that MICA was unique. But the bottom line is that in their eyes, we're still an insurance company, and what they told us was, is if we did not sign the closing agreement, and they were trying to work out a way for us to have some time here to work through all of this. If we did not sign that, they would in fact release an adverse revenue rule. In other words, they would declare us a taxable entity, and that would mean that we were going to be going to court. Our legal counsel advised us that we had less than a 50% chance of winning the court. In the meantime, this has been a contingency on our balance sheet. We've been running with this. That has a lot of implications. If we fought it, we would be fighting it for a long period of time. We worked very closely with the governor's office and the then director of the Division of Insurance, which was Mr. Walsh's predecessor, to try to ascertain if this was something that we could, in fact, take on and win. And talk to the Attorney General, and the general advice that we got, and we got advice from a lot of different sources, was that this was not something that we were going to fight and win. So.
Well, I have a question, and I kind of thought I understood something with Mr. Walsh's response to some questions, but you kind of might inform me. Now, the situation that we're in is as a result of an IRS action. But the step that we have taken is as a result of a policy made by this administration, is that correct? Okay, so that means that if we have a different administration, the policy could be different, and we could do something different?
Well, I think theoretically, yes, and I'm kind of on shaky ground here because I don't, you know, the rest is kind of personal opinion.
it seems very incongruous to me personally to have a state instrumentality be taxable. And although MICA certainly does not have an insubstantial amount of money, nor do they form an inconsequential service, it is nothing like the amount of money that's available or that would be subject to this kind of ruling should the IRS try to attach it to the permanent fund, for example. And I don't know what went into the overall policy decision not to challenge this in court, but a personal thought which occurred to me at the time was it's almost not worth taking because of the risk of losing it. Because if it is lost and a formal opinion is issued, it could have much more far-reaching ramifications than settling the issue with MICA before the 1/1/92 date occurs and not dealing with the issue, not fighting the issue with the IRS.
Well, of all these alternatives, which is the hardest one to take back? Or which is the hardest one, selling it, for example, which is the easiest thing to do and still buy us time and still give us an opportunity to work something out? And the reason that I'm concerned about it is that I think that I'm very concerned in terms of eventually being right back at the legislature again, figuring out a way to cover positions in the bush, you know, after this protection period is over. Then we're doing the same thing, we're facing the same problem, coming up with another state entity that's going to do the same thing that somehow is not going to be taxable. And it seems to me it would be a lot smarter to deal with it now rather than to take a half measure and perhaps take an action that we can't take back and then be right back in, you know, where we were when MICA was put together, spending more money, you know, et cetera.
I don't think, Representative Collins, that unfortunately any of these solutions is cut and dry. I think there's an upside and a downside to each one. The upside in terms of the sale of MICA is that, as I mentioned previously, MICA was designed to bridge a gap. We now have someone in the private sector who is willing to say that gap is bridged for 5 years.
Temporarily.
Well, it's for at least...
And that's my problem. It's temporary.
The thing is, for at least 5 years. And I think that from that side of the table, it is either alternative is defensible public policy, either saying we have now bridged the gap, if there's another gap in 5 years, we'll deal with it in 5 years. Or to say there may be another gap, and so even if this occurs, we will create Son of MICA in case that gap does occur. And again, unfortunately, there's an upside and downside to either solution. Doing nothing and saying we will now let the market function freely. The downside to that is that in 4 years and 6 months, we all may be sitting here doing the same thing again. The downside to creating a state facility in the eventuality that there is a gap in the market can essentially become a self-fulfilling prophecy. It can encourage private underwriters in the market to set their underwriting standards at a point sufficiently high that those who fall beneath that level will automatically come to the state. And it could arguably create a situation where the cream of the medical malpractice insurance that's out there will be taken by the private sector, knowing that this public sector is there and available to take the rest. And those are issues that, I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, couldn't tell you whether the upside or the downside will occur with either alternative. But I think those are kind of the choices and the risks with each one.
Representative Donnelly, if I could kind of piggyback on what Mr. Walsh was saying. I think the thing is, too, Representative Collins, that I don't know if I can guarantee something for 5 years. If MICA was to say exactly where we are right now, and we were to have a Prop 103 in Alaska, I'm not sure that I can tell you that MICA would continue to write the same policyholders or that it wouldn't increase its underwriting standards and do some things very differently over the next 5 year period of time. So I think that this is a commitment that you need to make and you need to look at from a business point of view. And the other thing is that no matter what happens, if in fact I believe seriously this company is committed to the state of Alaska. They have too much to lose in their own reputation not to take that commitment and take it seriously. And I haven't gotten any indication that they're not committed to if they're going to come here and buy a book of business which covers 50% of the physicians in all the rural hospitals in the state, that they're not committed to do exactly that. And they've taken a very long, hard look at us. But despite all of that, MICA has to change anyway. So even if you were to create some of MICA, it still has to be a very, very different structure. So the current MICA, the way I characterized it to the board, is that the current MICA cannot exist. I mean, it just can't exist because if
regardless
even some of MICA is going to be...
Regardless of the tax issue.
Yeah, regardless of the tax issue. So we've got, even if we have some of MICA, it's going to be a taxable entity. It's going to be vastly different from the current statute that is father MICA or mother MICA. Yeah, I think mother MICA better. so it's a change that has to be made. What we have to do is to figure out what change needs to be made and what's our main concern. And the main concern of the board has been with policyholders in the state of Alaska and with maintaining available insurance to those people and also maintaining that at the most affordable rate that we possibly can. Because in talking to our policyholders and talking to everybody else, that's what they've set up for us as the most important thing, is availability. So that's been a major criteria of the boards all along, and we have a company that is eager to meet those terms. And I just think that we're not going to get it much better. And in any case, we're running at a real short time frame. I mean, yes, we're not taxable till January 1st of 1992, but realistically, if we don't sell MICA, we're going to have to ask to be restructured by the legislature, and that only gives us a window of time until the end of the legislative session in early May of 1991. So we're talking about an seven-month window of time here, and that has been a real policy concern, I think, for the administration and certainly for the Board of Governors.
There was some. Did you want
to
go ahead?
I wanted to make just two more comments, Mr. Chairman. One is that, and Mary has touched on it a little bit, the situation with Michael over the last 15 years has provided a great deal of certainty, if not comfort, for the medical malpractice part of the insurance business. And the fact that that there is a potential buyer out there in the IRS agreement, there isn't any question that going down that road takes us into an area of substantial uncertainty. But it is not as if we are leaving a safe harbor, because with the changes in the insurance industry in general, and in particular in the medical malpractice area, many of the challenges that the new buyer and the legislature, et cetera, are going to face in that path would have been, we will all face anyway. The second thing that a distinction that I think is very important, this is important for me to always keep in front of my mind, is that the statutes clearly contemplate that when MICA receives a serious offer of purchase from a serious buyer, that they have to consider it. I mean, the statutes are written with a specific authority for sale. And my concern, I guess, is that the NorCal bid, if one is forthcoming, or any bid which is forthcoming in the next couple of months, has to be considered on its own merits as a business proposition. Now, admittedly, we may look upon it more favorably because of this IRS situation. But if the bid fulfills the requirements that the MICA board has set down, it's the kind of bid that ought to be seriously considered, whether the IRS agreement existed or not. And that's a very important distinction for me, because I don't want to get into the mindset and the division where we are considering this a fire sale. Because with the provisions that the MICA board has set down, it certainly is not, under any definition of the term, a fire sale. The kind of footnoted concern that I have is that a year from now, if we are sitting with 60 days to go before the end of the year, we will be in a fire sale situation. And the terms that we can ask of a potential buyer, the amount we can ask of a potential buyer, arguably go down dramatically.
Excuse me. There were two other witnesses signed up to testify, Mr. Campbell and Mr. Frazier. Were they here? Did they want to say anything? Are you just available for questions if you want to? If you want to give separate testimony, you're welcome to.
Just short.
Well, please, go ahead.
Okay.
Could you state your name, sir?
Yes, I would.
My name is David Frazier. I'm a member of the MICA board. I have been a part of the insurance industry in the state of Alaska for 20 years. I have always dealt with medical issues during that employment history. I'm currently one of the two original MICA board members. So I go back to Mother MICA back to 76. Obviously, this decision on your part and on our part is a very difficult one. I want to make it clear that from several of the board members, a minority of the board members, that a decision to sell isn't necessarily a unanimous decision. There are some of us that feel that if when we decided to privatize MICA because of the IRS pressure, that if we had anticipated that it was going to be a sale, we may not have supported that as wholeheartedly. I think that I have Alaska's best interest in mind as a board member, but obviously I have a slightly different view, as do a couple of other board members. I think I'm a friend of the board, and I believe that it's just a different way of thinking or a different philosophy here, perhaps. Although I know that the other board members have taken into consideration my views very seriously, as they have the other couple of members that are part of the minority. If the vote, I think, was taken today, if we had a good proposal from NorCal, I think that the board would probably recommend to the director of insurance that he accepted. Nevertheless, I think that MICA is an extremely valuable asset, and it's become so over the years. It's a good example of how the legislature has created a project that has come out right. We have some bad examples during the last 10 years that I think have been projects that we wished we hadn't created. We've had some good examples, and MICA is one of those excellent examples of what can happen right rather than what can happen wrong. And I think that it's due to hard work on the part of all the board members during the 15-year history of MICA, and I think it has a great deal to do with our staff. I'm in favor of a reorganization. I'm not in favor of MICA as is. I would rather see an Alaska-based company. I think that, again, we've got good employees, and I think we've got good financials. I don't want to see Alaskans lose jobs to Californians, and I don't want to see our premiums end up in San Francisco. Alaskans know and understand our environment best. I really am not sure what California knows about the healthcare business in places like Cordova and Nome, and Frankly, I think that although we're dealing with a company who has an excellent reputation for dealing with rural medicine, I believe that in most cases they can drive to any policyholder within 2 or 3 hours of the home office. I think that to a certain extent this may be an emotional issue with me, but I think that Alaskans have done a good job in handling the past, and I think they can handle it well in the future. For example, what if Carr Gottstein had sold to Albertsons? Would that company be the same today as it has been over the last few years? We've seen Western Airlines sell out to Delta Airlines. Have we been served better by that sale or not? I think that we each have our own way of answering these questions, and I think that they're philosophical ones. But the basis for desiring, or my desire, to keep Mica in Alaska and to have it Alaska owned is so that we'll be sensitive to the healthcare issues of Cordova and Nome, as well as those of Anchorage and Seward. Mica, again, is a small service-oriented company that has its insureds in mind. NorCal is a large monolithic company in California, as are most of the what I call bedpan mutuals in the lower 48. But I think they'll do a good job. I think they would do a good job, but I don't think that they'll change their modus operandi if they come to Alaska and be able to fit their way of doing business with Alaska's unique needs. It seems to me, in closing, that if we're going to build Alaska's resources, including its people, we must continue to operate small and large businesses which are domiciled here in the state of Alaska. I think we must take stock in the strengths we have and take the responsibility for fulfilling the challenges that belong only to Alaskans. Thank you very much.
As Fraser said earlier, he was concerned about the profits going to California, and yet, as I understand, the company, at least it has been related to me, that's owned by the policyholders. So if 300 Alaska policyholders are added to that group of 10,000, I would assume that they would participate in that distribution equally.
Probably,
as well.
Yes, probably.
Okay. And the other comment was about staff, about the business going to California. I would assume, that maybe I'm wrong, that some Alaskan staff, they may keep an office in Alaska, and we may even have the same staff, maybe have Mary Church, I don't know. And is that something that
well,
you would know?
There would be some duplication. We do some of the same things that other insurance companies do, so I wouldn't anticipate that they would require as large a staff here to service the book of business as we currently have. Therefore, some of the functions could be handled in San Francisco. For example, a finance and accounting could easily be handled there.
And then with elimination of some duplication, it's conceivable that could benefit, could come back to the policyholders in terms of profits.
It's possible. It's possible. My point is that it's too often we're served by companies in the lower 48 and we're not served enough by companies who are domiciled in Alaska. And I think that if we're to build the infrastructure and make long-term benefits for Alaskans, that Alaskans need to work in businesses that are domiciled here. So they gain that expertise, that's all.
Any further questions for the witness? Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Today. Appreciate it. I want to make sure if anybody else wants to. Sir, did you want to testify? And is there anyone else that's going to want to testify?
Yes, sir.
if you could just have, yeah, just name the fund.
I'm Keith Campbell, and I'm the hospital representative on the Board of Governors, the designated seat.
The Board of Governors is the MICA Board?
MICA Board of Governors, yes, Mr. Chairman. I think most of the board would empathize with David Frazier's point of view. However, and our gut tells us that this is a very nice philosophy to have, but my business sense in trying to eke out a living in a small rural hospital is that every dime that you can save must be saved, and we would look forward to, under this MICA sale, if it comes about, to potentially some lower rates, at least some stabilizing rates. You heard earlier in testimony that MICA is roughly a $20 million, $22 million total corporation, and NorCal is somewhere in the neighborhood of between $400 and $500 million. I suspect most of you would buy an insurance policy from a pretty big, solid organization. And my business sense tells me, and the constituency that I represent on this Board of Governors, that this is not a bad arrangement to have whatsoever. The practice of medicine in rural Alaska is pretty precarious. Our physicians are paying roughly 20-21% of their gross dollars in malpractice premiums. This is for the protection of the public, for those inadvertent times when a patient may be damaged. The hospitals do the same thing. This is a public policy issue with our local corporations, be they nonprofit or municipalities. And so we're looking for what we think is the biggest, soundest protection we can buy for the ultimate protection of the policy holder and the public who actually pays indirectly those premiums. No, I'm not wild about anything that's happened to Micah in the last couple of years. I sat in a long hot summer in 1975 helping to, around a committee table trying to design this beastie. And it's kind of a personal thing with me. But the fact is that the time marches on, and when the tax rules of 1986 taxed the Micahs, the Blue Crosses, these kind of public entities, then it's time to change, and we've had to change, and we will change. In talking to the other hospitals in the state, they're concerned about having a good, solid, viable company, by the way, which MICA is, but they see no reason that the anticipation of lower rates and stability, at least for the 5-year period of time, is something that they certainly look forward to.
Could I ask you about that? Now, the rates of insurance for these things are set state to state upon that state experience. I thought that was correct. Because we had this question back during our last hearings on these type of subjects where we had the Minnesota companies and stuff, and there was a real concern they weren't charging more in Alaska to subsidize what they were doing in Minnesota. Well, if it's from state to state, the experience, then how can you anticipate that having a bigger company is going to drop the cost of your premiums in Alaska?
Well, I think if you remember a statement that Mary made earlier on, that there's some 40% loading factor for reinsurance alone, and that a company of this size can go to London or wherever they buy their reinsurance and get it better. If they can get a 20%, for instance, loading factor for reinsurance, then some of that ultimately could be passed on to the premium payer.
Okay, so the real focus for that saving would be in the reinsurance market and having a bigger...
Well, the economies of scale.
In the reinsurance market, but not in Alaska itself.
We also have that contingency loading that I talked about, and part of that is for the reinsurance. Part of it is in there just because of our size, because of the type of business that we write affects our size.
Right.
NorCal doesn't have to worry about adding that into their rate because there's that financial stability there. So they have to put in the loss experience. It has to be Alaskan and loss experience, and it would be. But they don't have to add this loading in there, Representative Donlin, for the fact that they're a $22 million company instead, because they're not.
Right.
They're a $500 million company. So
I'd be real curious, though, how that loading factor and the ability to by reinsurance by volume will relate to their increased tax liability, since they will be subject to the federal tax and to the full state premium tax.
Well, they've looked at that, and I would suggest to you that if they buy MICA, they want to be a success. There's no reason that they want to fail. And they certainly don't want to get themselves into a situation where there isn't some benefit to buying MICA. And their financial analysts have looked at that, and they seriously feel that they can, maybe not immediately, but over time, decrease our rates in the state. And they can do that only because of the fact that they have to feel that they can purchase reinsurance and that they won't have to have this contingency factor, and that overrides the increase that they would have in taxes and the increase that they would occur in premium tax. I mean, they're not going to, they've looked at all of our financial statements and back to the inception of MICA, and they certainly aren't going to come forward with that, with an offer, come forward with that kind of statement unless they feel like they can carry on in the tradition that they've been carrying on in. In California, for the last 9 years, they've declared a dividend to their policyholders. So they have a whole reputation that they need to uphold, and they certainly don't want to be, they don't want to come into the market and buy into the major carrier in this market and not be a success. They don't have any reason to do that.
Okay, so, but there's a couple things there. The fact you provided dividend is only relative to what you charged, first of all, which what you charge is controlled by the division or whoever was regulating in the other state. But the next question there is that when they buy MICA, they're buying the better risks in Alaska, from what I can understand. Your portfolio's built, you've done a lot of cost control and worked with your clients and the insureds, and it seems like you're charging less than what the private insurers are charging for similar coverage, from what I remember from past hearings we've had.
Well, we are equal to MIEC as far, most of our rates are very comparable to MIEC. We aren't charging less. We have been able to stabilize our rates and decrease our rates over the period of time, but we've also increased our rates dramatically over the last few years too. So yeah. we've gone both ways.
Right. But one thing about the insurance business, I mean, it's a cost plus business. I mean, it's based on what you anticipated losses are, then plus your profit margin. So how, they're not going to have to worry about losing money if they're not making any commitments on rates anyhow. They're just making a commitment that they will maintain that coverage out there. Well, they're not really exposing themselves to any losses, because as soon as it becomes unprofitable for them, they just petition the division, which under the statutes, if it's proven that they need an increase, is going to grant them an increase. So they're not really risking any losses here, because the insurance is cost plus anyhow, right?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that kind of gets into the overall philosophy of insurance, and can an insurance company ever lose money? In one sense, if there is an offer from NorCal and if it's accepted, you're right. I mean, they will build their rate bases, et cetera. But there is no guarantee. First of all, neither MICA nor NorCal can give a guarantee on rates in the future. Nor will the division give a guarantee to MICA or any successor in interest that we will approve their rate filings. We very frequently do not, and require that their operations go down, that they don't declare a dividend, et cetera. So, you know, you certainly make the argument that an insurance company can never lose money because they will always increase rates, but that kind of begs the question of whether this is a commercially reasonable deal that MICA ought to enter into.
But that leads me to my next real problem here that I'm worried about, and that's while we have MICA, we have a balance. We have a measure for rates in Alaska for medical malpractice. I mean, we have this independent company that just deals with Alaska business that doesn't have a profit motive. That's related to the state government, And because of that, we have something to look to as an example for where rates should probably be. Once we lose MICA, the burden's really going to be more on the division than ever before to make sure that these outside companies aren't overcharging for their Alaska experience. We won't have MICA as something the division can look to as sort of a neutral actor in the field there that doesn't have a big profit motive. That's a fear I have out there. The second part of that is that once you eliminate the public entity as an option, the private sector has all the cards then. And how they, what they do with their actualities, and what they do with their rates, is they have much more leeway in it at that point in time than if we have a public sector alternative available to the people of Alaska as an alternative. Mary?
Well, Chairman Donnelly, MIC, who's our major competitor, is a nonprofit corporation. They are also a mutual corporation. NorCal is a nonprofit corporation. So there is no profit to be made or to be gained. So this cost plus sort of item, it technically, in some respects, is incorrect because the quote profit or the surplus in these two companies is owned by the policyholders and eventually goes back to the policyholders. So in the case of NorCal, I mean, one of the things that a director of the Division of Insurance of the State of Alaska once said to me was